Okay, folks, this is Elvin Shamroth here. Thank you for joining us once again, our bi-weekly teleseminar. And like I always begin each session, we get new people joining us every week. So very briefly, how this works, I invite candidates to submit questions regarding perhaps a case on the cases that they're concerned about, but really anything relating to the exam. But mostly it turns out complicated cases or particular issues, they're not sure how to defend, present, etc. And what I do is I mute everyone out so that there's no background noise, but myself and the active participant who's submitted a case or participants who have submitted their cases are unmuted, and so we can have a conversation, and that's what you'll hear. These sessions are, as I think you heard, all recorded, so you can access them via our archives. If you're not sure how to access them, please feel free to get in touch with the office, and they'll be happy to share that with you. These are totally unscripted. All I do is I get an email on the day of the teleseminar saying giving the first name of the active participant, what his or her issue is, and we take it from there, totally unscripted. So with that out of the way, today we have one active participant, and that is Nazanin. Nazanin, are you there?
Yes. You can call me Naz, Dr.
Shankar. I can call you what?
Naz, N-A-Z.
Naz, okay. Naz, thank you for joining us. And I've got the email that you sent in, but for the sake of everyone listening in, I want you to present your case so that everyone knows about the case, and then we can talk about it. But just as a general rule, whenever I ask candidates to present a case, I want you to, and this goes to everyone because I want to invite all of you in subsequent sessions to volunteer to be on the hot seat. It's good practice, it's good experience. But I want to encourage all of you to practice presenting cases very precisely and succinctly, not wasting time, because you don't want to waste the examiner's time. You want to give only the relevant information and try and avoid and leave out anything else. So with that in mind, Naz, would you go ahead and present your case to us?
Sure. My patient is a 37-year-old G5-2 at 39 weeks and 6 days, whose pregnancy has been complicated by AMA, iron deficiency anemia, prior C-section times 2, multiple leiomyoma, largest 6-centimeter in the lower uterine segment, and a breech presentation that's not a candidate for ECP. And so I delivered her via a repeat section, and which, you know, the fibroids got in the way, and I had to do an inverse T hysterotomy and also a myomectomy. The delivery was complicated by postpartum hemorrhage due to extensive hysterotomy and uterine apne, and the EBL was about 3,092 milliliters. At the time when I always consulted everyone for blood, but at the time she declined blood replacement. You know, we just did medication management, tried to close up the hysterotomy as soon as possible. And in postpartum, she just got IV iron infusion for her request rather than blood infusion.
Okay. It's a wonderful case. There's so many exam-rich questions, topics, conversations that this case can generate. It's a beautiful case. I've just got, and you presented it very nicely, by the way. But I got one question. Was this on the fact that she declined a blood transfusion? Was that on religious grounds, or on what basis was that?
No, there was a personal basis, I believe. So, I mean, in my residency, we always had religious reasons, and, you know, sometimes we missed those people, and then there was a need for blood, and then that would create a really dramatic situation for us. So I learned to just, you know, talk about blood replacement for anybody, especially, you know, scheduled C-sections. So at that time, she didn't have any, you know, any question, any, you know,
the point why I raised the question, and I, there's a general principle that I want to get all of you to appreciate. This is a person who went into her C-section starting off with iron deficiency anemia, and then she lost 3 liters. And she declined antepartum, which may or may not have been appropriate, but she certainly declined postpartum blood transfusion. Now, if she was refusing it on religious grounds, you can counsel her till the cows come home. It's a religious issue for this woman. We can't be judgmental, and we have to accept it. Counseling is always important, and even in that case, it's important to tell her you're at risk of dying. But in the non-religious objective to a transfusion, that counseling, any time, this is the point I want to drive home, any time a patient rejects a recommendation of yours, which is what has happened here. Anytime a patient rejects a recommendation of yours, you've really got to be prepared to describe how did you counsel her? Because typically we're going to recommend good and appropriate management. And if the patient declined, the examiner's going to want to know, did you counsel her appropriately? So just understand where the examiner's coming from. And as a general principle, it's pretty straightforward in this particular clinical scenario, but as a general principle, embellish slightly the factors in favor of what you're suggesting and minimize slightly the factors against what you're suggesting to show the examiner you're really trying to push this patient to get the blood transfusion or to take this treatment or that treatment. So that's the point I want to make. Whenever you've got declined counseling, declined this treatment or that treatment, be prepared for a discussion on counseling. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing I wanted to mention. There's a much bigger issue that I want to discuss with you folks. NICE has several potential conversations that she can generate from this one case. She can get the following conversations going: AMA, anemia in pregnancy, TOLAC-VBAC, leiomyomata during C-section, breech presentation, postpartum hemorrhage, and blood transfusion. Now, virtually all of those are very rich, exciting, meaty, juicy conversations to have in the exam. You could have half your case list in OB on this one case alone. Not that they would do that, but there's enough material here. So for those of you that have multi-issue cases on your list, I want you to go through what I'm going to take Naz through right now. So Naz, out of all those complications, let me get a pen so I can write them, just tick them off. Let's take them in order. Advanced AMA, do you think this is a great case to get to have an AMA conversation or not?
Not really. I mean...
Correct. There's so much more juicy stuff, number one.
Yeah.
And number two, you, I'm sure, have other cases on your list where you can try and get an AMA discussion going. So this, let's not waste this terrific case on a relatively boring discussion like AMA.
Uh-huh.
Fair enough?
Okay.
So we're not even going to mention the AMA in the antepartum complications column. We want to minimize, we don't want to drive the conversation in that direction. We want to drive it away from it. So we're not going to mention anything about AMA.
Okay.
What about anemia? Is this a good case to have to generate? So let me give you my feeling. It makes that much richer the conversation on why did she decline a transfusion, okay?
Yeah.
But number one. Number two,
uh-huh.
Again, I'm sure you've got other cases where you can get an anemia conversation going. And folks, remember, you might mention, as Naz has done, you might mention iron deficiency anemia, but the moment you've got the word anemia on your cases, you open yourself up. Not that it's a bad thing, but the conversation can potentially go down a B12, a folate, a hemoglobinopathy anemia conversation. So it can easily broaden into areas that, if you want to go that way, you've got to be comfortable and ready to handle them. So as far as this case is concerned, I think any PPH where there's a 3 liter plus blood loss, that alone captures a PPH conversation. And in that PPH conversation, you're going to get the transfusion conversation. You're going to get the religious object or whatever her reason was. That's going to come up. And so I would recommend, if you've got other cases on your cases with anemia, this is not the case to try and generate an anemia conversation, because there's so much more interesting than that, much more interesting stuff. Would you agree with that approach, Naz? Because at the end of the day, it's your cases. You got to defend it. It's what you are comfortable with. The next person listening in may feel differently, and neither of you are wrong. You're both right. But you got to what I'm trying to share with you, you've got to individualize your case list for your own individual strengths and comfort levels. So with all that being said, what do you think, Naz? Should we put down iron deficiency anemia or no?
Then probably not.
My inclination is no. For me, I wouldn't do it. Okay. What about the Tolac VBAC situation?
I mean,
do you think we should put that down?
I think it
must go down, because that's your reason for the C-section. And if you knew you had a myoma in the lower segment, if you had the option to avoid it, you would have done so, but she declined. So I think that has to come in, actually, to make the whole case consistent. So we're going to mention declined TOLAC, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Should we discuss the issue of multiple layer myomata?
Yes.
I think you're thinking about it. I think you have to.
Yeah.
Number one, this is a delicious conversation to have. And it also justifies the 3 liter blood loss. It fits very nicely.
Yeah.
And I think it should go down on paper. It's too important to that conversation, to leave it up to just saying it verbally, it's really got to go down in paper. Otherwise, the examiner might think you're just making it up as you go along. But if it's on paper, it's real, it's documented. So I would say that has to go down on, okay, in the case. Next one, breach.
Mm-hmm.
Should we put that down on paper?
Yeah, I mean...
Well, let me tell you. Is a previous C-section a contraindication to a breach?
No.
So I know previous C-section times one is not. I believe, and I could be wrong, I believe previous C-section times two also is not a contraindication. You can do it.
Yeah, we can do it, yeah.
So she declined it, or you wrote in your email she's not a candidate. On what basis is she not a candidate?
It was because of the 6-centimeter lower uterine segment.
Because you're concerned about this fibroid.
Yeah, so the fibroid
was
not letting a lot of movement.
Fair enough. Okay, makes total sense. So I'm debating whether or not to put breach down on paper. I would prefer, and folks, this goes to everyone listening in, notice what we're doing. We're evaluating all aspects of this case. Where do we want the conversation to go on this particular case? Where is it likely to go if we write down this, that, or the next thing? And I want you to do this. And in the beginning, for the first two or three cases, when you do this, it will take you a while. But you develop the knack of it very quickly, and it speeds up very quickly. In this instance, the breach, if you're going to put down breach, you're inviting questions on vaginal breach delivery and external cephalic version.
Oh, God.
Now,
yeah.
That, no, don't say, oh, God, that's a beautiful conversation to have. It really is.
Well, you know, I wanted to have a hemorrhage conversation right now. But,
correct, you know, correct. And that's the point I'm making. The breach is, to my thinking, is a bit of a distraction from where this conversation really needs to go.
I get it.
So for that reason, I would actually not put down breach, but I would mention it in passing verbally in the exam if at the time you felt it was appropriate. Okay, they're not going to think like you're making this up as you go along. Why would you? So it's something I would be comfortable to mention in the exam, but I wouldn't put it down on paper. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Next thing, PPH, obviously that's a biggie.
Right.
And with that will come the conversation, even though she declined it, they can ask you about blood component therapy, so that's going to come up, the blood transfusion issue. I'm just looking here. Okay, and in terms of your treatment, you mentioned AMA management. Again, I would ignore this totally. That's for another case. It's not for this case. Instead of you've given IV iron infusion.
So that was MC pardon for iron deficiency anemia.
It was antepartum. So look, we decided we're not going to put down iron deficiency anemia. So for that same reason, I think we should not put down iron infusion. If they ask you about it, you know, it's not like you're trying to hide things from them. Feel free to mention it verbally, but you want to try and... You don't want to be dishonest in the case list, but there's some things that you're entitled to highlight and some things that it's your choice if you want to minimize them, and this is one of them. AMA is another, okay? So I would not mention on paper the IV iron infusion. Now, the next thing you treated was repeat C-section with T hysterotomy and myomectomy. This is a beautiful exam topic, especially since she had a PPH. Mm-hmm. I think you'd agree this must go in, because they will ask you, what are your indications? Why did you do it? How did you do it? What's the pros and cons of a T versus a J incision? Mm-hmm. If you have a myomectomy in the lower segment, well, first of all, regardless of where it is, do you do a myomectomy at the time of C-section? What would you do if it was in the anterior lower segment? Would you consider a classical? And if you do a myomectomy, how do you close the defect? These are all beautiful questions. And then obviously, how do you monitor postpartum? Okay.
Yeah.
And then you got medical PPH management, which I like. You've come to our caseless construction course. Am I right or not?
Yes.
Yeah, because you mentioned the way you worded it, folks. She worded it what I strongly recommend. Virtually every one of you, you have a PPH on your case list. Instead of mentioning bimanual compression, uterine massage, Pitocin, ergometrin, prostaglandins, and listing everything as you go down the road, battery balloon, etc., rather be, and I tell this to everyone, be word poor in what you write down on the case list, and intentionally be somewhat vague, because in that vagueness, the examiner seeks clarification, and you get the conversation that you're looking for. So if you want to encourage a PPH conversation, put down, instead of mentioning bimanual compression and uterine massage, just put down what I call mechanical PPH treatment, RX. Okay? If you gave Pitocin, ergometrin, or prostaglandin, then you add, often mechanical, you add pharmacological PPH management. And then if you added a repair of sutures, if you had to do a hysterectomy or anything of that nature, you would add surgical PPH management. And before you did that, I forgot to mention, not in this case, but if you gave a blood transfusion, you would write hematological PPH management. You're purposely, I'm sure you can appreciate this, folks, but you're purposely being you're painting with a broad brush. And when the examiner sees that hematological PPH management, for example, the question is, what do you mean by that? What did you give her? And then you've captured the conversation on blood component therapy. So the principle here, be purposefully word poor and somewhat vague, because, and I've mentioned this before, you want to pique your examiner's curiosity. Because out of that curiosity that they're going to see clarification, and you're going to get the desired question. Mm-hmm. So does that all make sense to you, Naz?
Yes.
Okay. So we've discussed which issues you should drop and completely, and which issues you should highlight. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to you. Do you have any specific questions or concerns about this case?
Yeah, I mean, my concern is, to kind of tell you the story, is that so this woman, at the time of C-section, when she was losing blood, she didn't want blood transfusion because she was saying, "I feel fine." But we were like, "You're not fine." You know, we were seeing how much blood you're, losing. And then, so she, so me and anesthesiologist were talking to her as we were doing, the surgery, and she just says, I feel fine, I don't want it. So, you know, we give her a bolus. And, you know, the anesthesiologist updating me with blood pressure and pulse, and the ER is stable. But the nurses, they're telling me 3,000, we lost 3,000. So I think there is a discrepancy, too, because that nurse was training another new nurse. And I think, I mean, I'm pretty sure she lost about 1,500. But it was also surprising to me when she said 3 liters, because 3 liters, right? 3 liters.
Okay, fair enough. This is a mega PPH. It's a serious PPH.
So,
no question.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, if I saw that and I was an examiner, I would be like, have you not heard of the massive transfusion protocol? So I just don't know how do I get this across.
So it's very easy. Folks, you're going to hear me say this multiple times throughout the year. Totally open and honest. Mm-hmm. I would say the following. The nurse who was training someone at the time said that she had lost 3 liters. I've got to be honest. By my estimation, it was more like 1.5 liters.
Mm-hmm.
I discussed this case as I'm operating. I discussed this with the anesthesiologist. He or she also felt it wasn't quite 3 liters. And when we looked and evaluated the blood pressure and pulse, she was not a person in hypovolemic shock. So while her reserve may have been significantly down, she was okay, but we didn't know what could have happened the next minute or so. So I would have wanted her to have the transfusion, but she, despite counseling, both pre-op and now intra-op, I'm assuming she had an epidural, yes?
Yeah, she had
a spinal.
Epidural, yeah.
Yeah. So despite everything, she still declined. You've got to be prepared to discuss what are your criteria for a blood transfusion. How many units will you order based on how much blood is lost? What is the ratio of, you know, I've forgotten this, I've got to be honest, of patriot blood cells to FFP. There was one other thing I wanted to mention. What is the blood volume and the hematocrit, how does that change in normal physiological pregnancy? Because that's a part of this equation and conversation as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she declined it is fine. Just you folks have to be comfortable to share with your examiner verbally how you tackled this problem. Okay, they want to know what, not that she refused and you couldn't give her. They want to know, how did you evaluate the situation? So think aloud. And as you answer that question, okay? Now, I'm just going to take this for a moment down a hypothetical pathway. And folks, a significant portion of, small but significant portion of you may well find yourself facing this question or something similar to it. Let's say this patient was a person who, on religious grounds, had said she doesn't want a blood transfusion under any circumstances, and you had counseled her appropriately pre-op. And now, as luck would have it, you have this major complication. You've now done everything. I'm just fast-forwarding for the sake of simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
You've done everything, including the hysterectomy. You've done everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you now know your back is to the wall. It's come down to the wire. And you either give this patient a blood transfusion or you know, and the anesthesiologist has confirmed she's going to die. I mean, it's just, I'm purposely putting your back to the wall. That's the situation. How are you going to handle that? What will you say in the exam?
Oh, my God. That is tough.
Sorry, what did you say? Let us?
Very tough.
Oh, I thought you said, let us pray, which might be one of the better things to do. Sorry, go ahead, yeah? I'm listening.
I had the similar thing in residency. So patient with Jehovah's Witness, patient was vacuumed, shoulder dystocia, massive postpartum hemorrhage, to a point that we're moving her to the OR, and that's when we find out she's Jehovah's Witness. So that's my...
Okay, so you've got a bit of personal experience in this regard. Let me put you back in the situation. You know, and the examiner will tell you, you either give her the blood transfusion or she's going to die. What are you going to say to him or her in the exam?
I mean, so I would say I would counsel her that there is no other way that we can...
You're just procrastinating.
Yeah.
You counsel her and she just lost another 300 cc's of blood.
Oh, God.
What, I'm not going to take the question away from you. I'm forcing you to confront it. What are you going to do?
I mean, honestly, what we did was extensively talking to the husband and the wife who was on their spinal.
Okay, I got to stop you there.
Okay.
Because don't tell me where you did your residency. But folks, to all of you listening in, and this is the classical scenario. If you say to the examiner, I would discuss it with the husband. The examiner is going to say what to you? The examiner is going to say, the husband's begging you to give the blood transfusion and save his wife. He or she's not going to give you an easy out there. They're going to come down even harder. Now the husband's pushing you now to give the blood transfusion. The question still remains, what are you going to do? So you think I may have made it easier, not necessarily so. The point that I wanted to make is your contract, folks, is with the patient, not her husband, not her boyfriend, not her mother.
Yeah.
It's with the patient. You can't, if the husband agrees with the patient, that helps.
Mm-hmm.
But if they will give you a situation where the husband disagrees in the exam. So in practice, fine, you can do whatever you want, but in the exam, they would, if they said, what about speaking to the husband? Your answer would be, as much as I would like to, my obligation is primarily to the patient, not the husband. So I might still give it on different grounds, but not on the basis that the husband requested. Okay? So, I phrased the question purposely the way I did, because I still want to keep the options open for you. What are you going to do? The examiner's not going to let you squirm out of this one, and neither am I, so give it your best shot, Ness.
Well, I mean, honestly, I would do anything in my power to help her.
So you're going to give her a blood transfusion then? You've got the blood in your hand.
No,
put it up. No, you're going to do...
No.
What you going to do?
Oh.
By the way, the examiner will not give you the amount of time that I'm giving you.
Yeah, I know.
But I'm doing it because there are a couple of issues I want to drive home. So you've got to give me an answer. What are you going to do? You've got life-saving treatment in your hand.
Yeah,
and
I
she's going down.
Do
you would give the blood transfusion. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And, Naz, I'm telling you from experience, probably 3/4 of the people listening in are clapping and say, yay, Naz, I would do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the answer from a practice point of view is probably once you've done that, you take out your checkbook and you just say, how much do you want? And you write a check for whatever number they give you because it's indefensible in court. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, number one, you don't give it. And the the way you handle that, I mean, I would answer this way. There might be, if it's clear cut that the patient doesn't want it, and now I'm discussing with her in labor, she might be under duress and doesn't fully experience this, understand, appreciate what's going on. There might be some room to go against her patients, against her wishes. But if it is clear when she was not under duress that she had clearly stated and it's documented that she doesn't want a blood transfusion to the point of death, I have, as tragic as it is, I have no, you use these words, as tragic as it is, I have no choice but to respect this patient's wishes. It's one of the fundamental pillars of medical ethics, which is autonomy. And I cannot take that from her. So it's tragic, but I would have to respect her wishes. How does that sound to you as I presented to you that way?
Yeah, you're right. That sounds great for exam.
Yeah, and look, folks, at the end of the day, what you do in practice is a separate issue. But I want you folks to pass the exam. That's what we're all here for.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's what I ended up, like, you know, doing with this patient, kind of like, you know, respecting her wishes, even though, like, you know, I did not, I was like on the other side of the bed, I was just like dying myself.
But you know, it's okay if the doctor dies, it's not so okay if the patient dies.
I know,
okay.
So, I mean, yeah, like, you know, of course, like, I monitored her closely and still, like, counseled her. So I was talking to her and anesthesiologist the whole time.
And you emphasize that. You say that. There was collaborative discussions going on. But you've got to be comfortable, and I encourage all of you to use those words. This is tragic, but I must respect the patient's wishes, and I would have to withhold. Okay?
That's
the point I wanted to drive home. Now, coming back to you, did we cover the issue that you had spoken about, that you had, you were concerned about?
Yes.
Okay, is there anything else on this case that you wanted to discuss?
No, I just wanted to tell you that the H&H went from 12 to 8, so still don't think it was 3 liters. But
okay, and you've got to be able to say verbally, if it was a 3-liter EBL, how much would you expect the platelet count at the acute moment and then after stabilization to drop to, you know? So, you know, it's fair to add that in afterwards, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
All right, so you're comfortable with this case?
Yeah.
Okay. Folks, to everyone listening, this was a very, it's a beautiful case for NAS, but there are a lot of principles that we went through on this case that are relevant to every single one of you listening in and relevant for you in the vast majority of your cases. The process of deciding which conversations you want to have, that's a very big deal. And I encourage you to do it. And I'll get a plug in when those of you who have not yet, you may want to still consider attending our Cases Construction course. It's the one single thing that you can do that really will have the greatest impact. I'll stick my neck out. Naz, you said you came to our Cases Construction course, yes?
Yes.
Be honest, please. Tell everyone your impression of that. And if you think it was a lousy course, say so. Be honest. Did you think it did it change your perspective on the case list and how to put it together?
Yeah, for sure. We always have a lot of attendings in residency that went through the same thing, and everybody telling you different things. And I was very confused in general. So going through that, and especially knowing that you can kind of direct the examiner at least for that 30 minutes.
yes.
You
can get the examiner to ask you the questions that you want. And I think you saw it's not difficult at all, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we sort of touched on that process today when we presented this case. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm pleased we're done with it, and that's good. Folks, we're almost out of time. A couple of comments I just want to make before we sign off. It was brought to my attention yesterday. You folks may have received an email from ABOG. Naz, you can verify or not this for me, stating about the GYN categories. Did you get it in your inbox, or was just when you signed up onto your page on the ABOG website?
I believe everybody got it in their inbox that registered on the website.
Go ahead.
Because last webinar I had questions about my suction DNCs.
That resolves that problem. Let me give a little bit of background. You all got the email. If you didn't see it, check your inbox. It's there. But in essence, up until last year, and including last year, on the GYN side, there were 33 categories that you could choose from, which made getting 20 cases to count, because only the first two cases in any one category count, to get 20 cases that count was very, or relatively speaking, pretty easy. This year, they reduced the number of categories from 33 down to 17, and it caused a furore amongst our candidates complaining to us at ExamPro, which we can handle as part of our job, but it obviously caused a furore up at ABOG as well. So what they did, they basically, and I speak open to correction, but I took a brief glance at this. They reinstituted the list of G1 categories. So I think you're back to 33 categories, which makes your, if you've got, say, 25 or 30 cases, it makes your ability to make sure that you've got 20 cases there that count, makes it much, much easier. I'm just surprised that ABOG made this correction as quickly as it did, and to their credit, in my opinion. So I just wanted to make sure that all of you are aware that this issue did come down in the last couple of days, and it makes your lives a lot easier as far as the G1 side is concerned. Okay. Last question. Naz, I always like to encourage other people to volunteer to be on the hot seat. Number one, to everyone listening, you'll notice I didn't mention Naz's name, last name. I don't have it. I couldn't even if I tried. And I always keep you folks anonymous. So you don't need to be fearful if you don't know an answer to a question and you feel embarrassed. There's none of that. But now's my question to you. Again, please be honest. Did you find this was helpful for you today or not? And please be honest.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I feel like I'm in hot seat every week sending cases. So No, definitely helpful to me.
Excellent. Excellent. So, folks, listen, please volunteer. It's free, and free is good. So please volunteer the next time and every other time. We do this every other week. So the next teleseminar is actually going to be, as it typically is, in 2 weeks' time. So it makes it the 17th of March. That's when we'll do this all over again. To Naz, thank you so much. I think it was a great case and a very nice discussion. And to everyone listening in, thank you for joining. And we'll speak again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you once again, folks. And this concludes the teleseminar. Take care and bye-bye.